the Seminoles were a relatively small, about 500 person population, living largely in the kind of near Everglades in the 19-teens. And when they realized that there were opportunities to be had in the development of this tourist infrastructure, Tony Tommy, among several others, began finding ways to create a kind of frontier vacation experience. And so he worked with local hoteliers. He actually worked with the famous, or some might say infamous, film director D.W. Griffith to try to use Seminoles in local films to try to make Miami and Hollywood a kind of a film destination that ultimately gave way to Hollywood, California. And Tony Tommy was an elaborate showman. He actually made sure that his Seminoles would carve totem poles reminiscent of Northwestern tribes, and they would have these cheeky huts or these kind of living exhibits where they would work and allow vacationers to come and just observe Seminoles in day-to-day life.
And he hosted weddings as well for people to watch.
That's right. So some people who may have been married once, twice, or three times over would get married for a fee and charge admission. Many of them had children. And just so that they could extend the tourist season and say that you had seen a genuine Seminole wedding on your trip to South Florida. The greatest spectacle that Tommy was involved in was the actual transfer of 150,000 acres of Seminole land to the Miami Chamber of Commerce. And the ceremony, as I describe in the book, was quite elaborate. And it consisted of him wearing a headdress from the Plains Indian tribes and grabbing a peace pipe from the Iroquois nations and literally speaking in Miccosukee, even though he spoke fluent English, how the white man was a child of destiny and the red man was a child of nature. And it was time for the child of nature to surrender to the child of destiny. And he actually invented a Seminole flag that did not exist, and just so he could surrender it to the Miami Chamber of Commerce president, a man by the name of Lonworth Crow. And that land ended up being what now stands under Miami Lakes. It makes up Hialeah. And there's a whole story about the development of Miami's suburban kind of communities in the Northwest that really does begin with a 1927 land transfer organized by Tony Tommy in the Miami Chamber.
Did the Seminoles look down on the African Americans? Because going through the book, I remember a story too. I think of a Seminole woman who had a child with an African American man. I mean, did they look down on African Americans because there was a hatred between the groups, or were they doing it simply because they were trying to stay on a certain side with whites?
Right. So the example that you're pointing to is a woman who gets involved with, I believe, a West Indian man. They have a child, and the child is given a kind of off-color name that I really can't repeat on the air, unfortunately. And it's a problem that it's unique to the Seminoles in the sense of, you know, there's a deep history there of African slaves intermarrying with Creek Indians to even create the Seminole people in Florida in the early 19th century. But even in broader terms, and this is actually really critical to the book's central argument, that having a certain kind of anti-black position seemingly makes a lot of sense for getting what you want out of Miami's Jim Crow order. In other words, you see Seminoles who adopt a certain kind of negative position towards African Americans. You see many West Indian blacks who are coming in from abroad who also adopt a somewhat negative opinion of American-born black people. You see many affluent African Americans who are dentists and lawyers who similarly have a negative opinion of poor African Americans. And part of what becomes the kind of common sense of Jim Crow is needing to confine and in some cases exact violence against the poorer black populations in the region. And it becomes very difficult for anyone from these marginal groups to have any say in how elections are going to be carried out, what new infrastructure is going to be developed, how tenants are going to be protected. And there's a consistent marginalizing of the black poor from early in the 1900s deep into the 1960s and 70s. And I actually argue in the book that one of the kind of key continuities from the Jim Crow era to the post-Jim Crow era is the consistent marginalization of the black poor in the city of Miami. There's very little stake that they have in politics, very little stake they have in the economic future, and part of that is owing to a political culture that developed and consistently marginalized them from the era of the Seminoles and their tourism through the Jim Crow era and beyond.